Andy, this is a conversation I've been looking forward to for so long. I can't tell you, I'm really pretty excited just to have you on the show. Should have done it years ago. Thank you for joining us on Planetary Radio.
Thank you, Matt. It's really a pleasure to be here.
All right, I'm going to start right up front, make very clear my bias. I finished the book 2-3 days ago. I do not usually get the chance to speak in the first person plural on this show, but folks, if you are a regular listener to this show, I have to tell you, this is our book. You need to read this book. If it were a song, it would be the anthem of the explorer. And by explorer, I include not just those with a passion for Mars, but all good scientists. And I think this book is as much, if not more, about that than it is about Mars itself. Andy, there you go. I'm not holding back.
Well, you know, I think I may actually steal some of what you said and put it on my website because it's wonderful. And I have to say that when I was writing this book, and this one took 4 years, which was only half as long as I spent writing A Man on the Moon, but it was a long, hard 4 years. It was a different kind of writing for me. But really, I think my goal was not only to reach the general public, of course, but to give something to all of the diehards out there, the mm-hmm. real Mars lovers, the real lovers of space exploration, and even especially the people who have made space exploration happen. You know, I feel that with this book, I am trying to give something back to them for making this such an incredible time to be alive. Some of them, you know, as you read, are people that I've known in my life and have been close to, and others I've only read about, but all of them, I think, are, you know, we're all sort of kindred spirits.
Well, I want to talk about a lot of those people, but really, you go back to Percival Lowell, and before that, I mean, from Percival Lowell to Steve Squires and beyond, right. It is this passion that all these guys shared, even if they didn't really share much else in characteristics.
Right, and I think Lowell is a perfect example of how Mars literally casts a spell over human beings. Everywhere you look in the history of the study of Mars and the exploration of Mars, you find that it is a planet that, over and above all the other worlds of our solar system, really captures the human mind, the human spirit. And people have a way of just turning their lives in the direction of Mars again and again and again. And, you know, the anecdote that I open the book with of Bruce Murray looking at Mars for the very first time through the 60-inch telescope at Mount Wilson in the fall of 1960, there's Bruce as a geologist who up till this time has been more involved with oil exploration than anything else, and he's done a little bit of work with the satellite technology, the emerging world of satellite technology as part of the Cold War and as part of his Air Force experience. But now he's at Caltech, and as one of the perks of being at Caltech, he gets to go up to Mount Wilson, look through the 60-inch at Mars. And on this October night in 1960, he literally, by his own description, falls in love with Mars. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And that is the moment that I picked to begin the story, because that is the moment at which Mars changed from an astronomical object into a geologic one. It changed from the blurry, almost apparition in astronomers' telescopes that was maddeningly vague, even on the best of times, into a world that we could really go explore and find out what's really there. Of course, that what's really there is something that we are still learning, and that process has been unfolding now for several decades. But that is emblematic of the book, the fact that here is Bruce Murray, who's a very kind of matter-of-fact, not a romantic guy. As I say in the book, his whole approach to science was, you know, just the facts. But as I say, he literally was falling in love with Mars.
I'm so glad that you started with Bruce, and I want to talk more about him. But I think, as you've just said, this seems to be another one of the characteristics of scientists, at least the really good ones. Your book, I think, is one of the best expressions of what I've always felt is so misunderstood about scientists, that
right.
though their methods must be painstakingly rational and measured, sometimes maddeningly so, their imaginations and their spirits are often utterly unbound.
That's exactly right. And I plead guilty to being that way myself. My methods are not always as rational, but then again, I'm a writer, so I can be, more sort of right brain and more emotional in my approach to my subject. But I think that is something that people don't understand about scientists and engineers even, mm-hmm. who make space exploration happen. Steve Squires told me that it was passion that got those two rovers, Spirit and Opportunity, to the launch pad. It was passion that resurrected the Mars program after the failure of Mars Polar Lander and Mars Climate Orbiter in 1999. One of the guys that helped make that happen, Jim Garvin, was one of my college classmates, and we were in the same dorm together at Brown University. And my God, you know, Jim Garvin is one of the most passionate people I've ever known in my entire life. The passion of somebody like Tom Paine, who was running NASA at the time of Apollo and took it on himself to try and convince Richard Nixon to support a manned Mars program in the summer of 1969. Even as we were reaching the moon, he was looking ahead. Paine was looking ahead to a future in space that would be onward and upward with Mars as its most alluring centerpiece. And of course, Nixon wasn't buying, and Paine ended up leaving NASA a year later. But he came back with the graduate students at University of Colorado in Boulder who created the Mars Underground.
And these crazy young people, right.
That's right. And so the other thing about this story is it's a multi-generational passion. It is a passion that cannot be measured in terms of one person's career, one person's lifetime. It's a passion that, as you say, goes all the way back to Percival Lowell and continues right up to today.
Do you think those young folks, those Mars geeks and the Mars Underground, did they play a big role in reviving Mars for us Earthlings?
Absolutely. You know, when they came on the scene in the early 1980s, the late 70s and the early 80s, and I'm talking now about Chris McKay, Carol Stoker, Penny Boston, Tom Meyer, and Steve Welch, and by the way, a young artist who is now at the Hayden Planetarium in New York City, Carter Emhart. And one of the things that I really was thrilled about in this book is to be able to use Carter's artwork and some of the other inspirational artwork that goes along with the vision for Mars. But they came along at a time when NASA had turned away from deep space, human exploration in deep space. Apollo was over. NASA was consumed with getting the space shuttle flying, the goal of reducing the cost of access to low Earth orbit with the shuttle. They then moved on to a program for a permanent space station in Earth orbit. So they really had a full plate with the human spaceflight program that had nothing to do with Mars, nothing to do with the moon or Mars. And these grad students who had grown up with the space age and had been just starting their graduate school careers when Viking landed on Mars were absolutely galvanized by that, and they refused to take no for an answer. And what they found was that as they began to organize their energies into a conference called The Case for Mars, they found that there were people all over NASA, all over the aerospace community, who were almost in secret working to advance concepts for Mars exploration. And they provided the gathering place, the nucleus, the process of hashing out ideas that literally took the place of what would normally have been done by NASA. They were creating their own space program on the campus of University of Colorado at Boulder, and that became the Case for Mars conference proceedings and was the forerunner of Bob Zubrin's plans called Mars Direct, which of course now has become part of the mainstay of how we plan to go to Mars. So they were tremendously important and tremendously influential, and they're unbelievably passionate people. They're just the the combination of passion and intelligence is absolutely irresistible to me. You know, I find myself in my life drawn to people like that again and again and again, and it just so happens that the Mars community is full of them.
Yeah, you were talking about the Mars Underground and in the third person, but I think you were, what, at least what could be called an ex officio member of that group?
Well, I was at the time of the second Mars Underground conference, the second Case for Mars conference in 1984. I was an editor at Sky and Telescope magazine and was beginning to branch out into freelance writing. And I remember getting a call from a former Sky and Telescope alum who was then at Discover magazine named Dennis Overby. And your listeners may know Dennis now as one of the mainstays at the New York Times science department, science reporting, and has written a number of fine books and is a superb science reporter. But Dennis was at that time one of the editors at Discover, and he said, how would you like to write a story about these crazy guys in Boulder who are trying to get Mars onto NASA's radar screen? And I thought, that sounds cool. So that summer, July of 84, I went to Boulder, and that's when I met those guys. That's when I went to the second Case for Mars conference, and I met Penny Boston and Carol Stoker and Chris McKay, and I met Carter then, and Tom Paine was there. I got to know Tom Paine, which was a great thrill for me. This was also just at the time when I was starting to think about writing A Man on the Moon. But I, of course, had been an Apollo nut since the time it was happening, and so that was a tremendous thrill. And I never really would consider myself a member of the organization, but I was certainly...
You were certainly a kindred spirit.
I was definitely a kindred spirit and still am. And one of the great things about writing this book has been to go back and revisit episodes like that from my own history. You know, not just the Case for Mars, but Viking, which was an incredibly exciting time in my life when I was in college and got to be an intern on the first Viking landing at JPL.
Mm-hmm.
You know, all through my career as a journalist, I've interviewed people who've been involved in Mars exploration. When the meteorite happened about 10 years ago, when the Allen Hills meteorite, Martian meteorite, that there was a claim that there were fossil bacteria inside that meteorite, I covered that for Popular Science. And the first person I called and ended up spending quite a bit of time talking about that with was Jerry Soffin, who I'd gotten to know during Viking. He was the project scientist on that mission. He was a NASA biologist who was a driving force behind the search for life beyond Earth and led the process of developing life detection experiments for Viking. He was just a wonderful human being, tremendously inspiring, was somewhat of a mentor to me and to so many other young people. And here we were 20 years after Viking, where Viking had seemed to close the door on the possibility of life on Mars, and now we had this meteorite. And Jerry said that for him, it was almost like a second childhood.
Mm-hmm.
It was just a tremendously exciting time for him, just to have the possibility of knowing perhaps what the answer to the question, are we alone, really is. So, you know, the multi-generational aspect, the fact that these are people whose involvement with Mars spans decades and changing understanding, and just the story is just so rich because of that.
You dedicated the book, in fact, to two gentlemen, Jerry Soffin and Tim Mutch, who also had a profound effect on your life.
That's right. Tim was a geology professor at Brown University. I had known of his work even when I was in high school because he had written a book called The Geology of the Moon. And when I was just awakening to my interest in geology and in wanting to be a planetary geologist, which was, I have to say, really sparked as much as anything by Mariner 9 and the discovery of those giant volcanoes on Mars and the vast canyons, and the people that I saw on TV talking about these exciting things were geologists. And I began to think, huh, you know, that may be what I want to do. When I was applying for colleges, Brown was one of the places I went. And while I was having my interview, I mentioned Dr. Much, and I said that I'd seen his book. And they said, well, you know, he's leading a conference of Mars scientists today on campus. And if you'd like, you can go meet him. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. So I went over to where he was, and he was incredibly gracious. He invited me to come and sit in the back of the room. I mean, I was, 17 at the time. I looked about 12. And I'm sure the other people in the conference wondered what this kid was doing sitting in the back of the room. But that was typical of Tim Much. He opened his world to young people who were excited about space exploration and about discovery. And then when I was at Brown, I took classes from him, and I worked for him in the little room that we call the Mars Room, where all of the initial test data for Viking was being analyzed. He was in charge of the camera team for the Viking landers. And so it was too good to be true, really, that there I was at Brown, and my concentration advisor was the head of the Viking camera team. Through a program with NASA, they had several dozen college undergraduates come to JPL during the summer of the Viking mission and serve on the various science teams as undergraduate interns. I was selected. It was a competitive process. I was selected, and I was on the lander imaging team as an intern that entire summer. I spent the entire summer at JPL. Actually, it was one of three summers I spent there during college. You know, my God, what an incredible experience to be there. In fact, one of my early memories of that was a party welcoming us that Jerry Sofen gave, and Carl Sagan was at the party. Of course, I'd seen Carl on Johnny Carson and other places, and he was already a huge fan of his. And I remember him saying that we interns were essentially cabin boys on the Santa Maria. And that was quite an image to carry around with you.
Yeah. You profile so many of these wonderful people, and you do it warts and all, and still their basic heroism is how I think of it, really shines through. You already talked about Bruce Murray, one of the greatest human beings I've ever personally met. And, you know, Carl Sagan, now here are two guys who spent a good part of their many years together arguing with each other. Without reservation, and yet they were able to get together with Lou Friedman and start the Planetary Society. And, you know, it's my colleagues at the Society who told me that these guys never stopped going at each other, and yet they were still united.
That's right. I can just imagine. You know, it's a neat story because Bruce came at this with of the feeling that, you know, especially after Mariner 4, which Bruce was the younger member, the junior member of the imaging team on Mariner 4. So here he is in 1965. Mariner 4 flies past Mars. Nobody's ever seen what the surface of Mars is like up close. And the shock of that mission is that the pictures show that there are craters on Mars. There are very large craters on Mars. And that right away told them that there was a very ancient surface that had not been modified since the very earliest history of the solar system. Now, of course, they knew that they were only seeing a small portion of Mars, but nevertheless, the impression was indelible that Mars was not the Earth-like, the Earth analog that many scientists had suspected and that many in the public even had hoped, and that it was an abode of life, and that it would turn out to be the most Earth-like world in the solar system. Here was a world that looked like the moon. And furthermore, the other instruments on Mariner 4 revealed that the atmosphere was exceedingly thin, just a tiny fraction of what it is on Earth. No ozone layer to screen out harmful radiation from the sun. So basically, you're talking about an ancient, frigid, radiation-bathed desert.
Lovely place, it sounds like, doesn't it? At that point, anyway.
Yes, and the New York Times came out with an editorial right after Mariner 4 that called it the dead planet instead of the red planet.
Yeah.
Now, on the other hand, you have Carl Sagan. And Carl's approach was in many ways a mirror image of Bruce's. Bruce was the kind of man who, as I say in the book, stared unblinkingly at the facts, whereas Carl looked at those same facts and stubbornly pointed out what they did not rule out. He was interested in the possibilities that were not ruled out by the facts.
Which was maddening to Murray.
It was maddening, that's right. And so they went at it. One of the most memorable, probably the most memorable example of that, was a symposium that Bruce organized at Caltech the day before Mariner 9 went into orbit. Bruce was on a stage with Carl and with Ray Bradbury and Arthur C. Clarke, and it was moderated by Walter Sullivan, who was the science correspondent for the New York Times, and it was what Murray called a tag team wrestling match. Only it seemed at times as if Murray was the only one on his team, and everybody else was kind of, you know, against him. And it was made into a book, which I think was one of the best books about Mars ever done, and was tremendously influential on me, not only for the science, but also for the poetry and the discourse. I mean, that was where I discovered Ray Bradbury. I was not I still am not a science fiction reader, but Ray's poetry and his prose, his statements about Mars and about space exploration, you know, were incredibly and still are incredibly powerful. Bruce, to his credit, realized that he needed to change his view as time went on. You know, Mariner 9 went into orbit and found not only these giant volcanoes and canyons, but these ancient river valleys that indicated, you know, without a doubt, that Mars had once been a much more hospitable place.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, Bruce had to stop and rethink his view. He did it again when the meteorite happened 10 years ago. You know, Jerry Sopin said that, you know, he and Bruce had always gone at it too, but when they were at a conference together and Jerry heard Bruce get up and give a talk that left the possibility open of life on Mars, it was a long time coming, but they were finally on the same side.
You mention in the book this great phrase that Murray rechristened Mars as the land of broken paradigms.
Yes, and that really came out of the Mars Global Surveyor mission. And in particular, the instruments, that one instrument called MOLA, that has mapped the topography of Mars in exquisite detail, and that was the, as much as anybody, Jim Garvin was the driving force behind that.
That was the laser altimeter, right?
Exactly. So MGS circled Mars, this laser took thousands upon thousands of readings of the elevation of the surface, and then those were combined into a global topographic map of Mars, and for the first time gave Mars its third dimension and allowed people to really see what the lay of the land was, not just looking at photographic evidence. Now, the other thing, of course, on Mars Global Surveyor was an incredibly powerful camera that was created by Mike Malin, who had been Bruce's student. And, again, the multi-generational quest. Bruce had been Mike Malin's advisor, came to Malin's office to see some of these new images coming down that now showed features just a few feet across, you know, in some cases. Unprecedented detail, and revealed a planet far more complex, far more mysterious and fascinating than we had even realized at that time. So, yes, Bruce has called Mars the land of broken paradigms.
Malin is another one of these guys who continues in many ways to stand apart, a bit of an iconoclast, and not someone who suffers fools lightly, but his vision brought us this continuing evolution in the view of Mars.
I've known Mike ever since Viking, when he was a postdoc and really struck me as one of the most insightful people I'd ever come across. And I am so much in admiration of how he stuck to his guns at a time when the rest of the scientific community was saying, we don't need any more pictures of Mars. We've gotten everything we needed from Viking. and you know, the competition for space on every new mission was fierce, and they felt that a camera would take up too much weight, too much power. Mike and his team, Mike put together a team, and they developed a camera with no moving parts that outperformed anything that has ever that had ever been sent to another planet before. And that camera was on the Mars Observer spacecraft that ended up being lost just before entering Mars orbit in 1993. And then the backup camera was put on the kind of recovery mission from that failure, which became Mars Global Surveyor. And so, Mike, the thing you find out as you talk to Mars explorers is that, you know, you've got to be in this for the long haul. You know, Mike started his quest to put that camera around Mars in the mid-1980s, and it wasn't until the late 1990s that it got there. Of course, it worked for 7 years and made incredible discoveries. You know, the opening image that I use in that chapter shows these bizarre pits in the South Polar ice cap. And, of course, the cap is made of frozen water with a covering of frozen carbon dioxide. And so these pits are etched in the frozen carbon dioxide. They were like nothing that anybody had ever seen before. They even left Mike shaking his head. And that's just one of countless things that when you look at Mars at this new scale, it looks nothing like the planet that we thought we knew from Viking. Just bizarre things that are going to keep people busy for years and years to come.
Before we move on, say a word or two about Mike Malin's associate, Ken Edgett, who may know Mars better than any other human being.
Well, they really have been a team. Ken had been one of Mike's students in Arizona for a time and then went to work for Mike. Ken really dug in and became kind of the day-to-day honcho of the process of choosing targets for new images and looking at the images that were coming down by the hundreds, you know. I mean, when the mission was finished, it was several hundred thousand images. And Ken has looked at every single one of them. And as Mike himself says, Ken knows Mars better than anybody. You know, the thing that I found talking to Ken is you have to keep an open mind with this planet. You must check your hubris at the door. If there's one bumper sticker for Mars, it would be, you know, if you think you have this place figured out, think again. And I think the thing about Ken is that he knows what he doesn't know. He understands that any explanations that they come up with are approximations of the truth. Most of all, you cannot let yourself be caught up too much in the theories of the past, in the old Mariner and Viking Mars, which I guess, you know, still hangs on in some senses, although probably less and less as time goes on, especially with the new data from HiRISE, which is on Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter, and is, of course, even more powerful than Mike's camera on Global Surveyor. But, you know, it really is interesting to hear Mike and Ken both talk about how difficult it has been at times to get other Mars scientists to see the planet that they see when they look at Global Surveyor's images.
Speaking of images, the book is full of them. You have many of the best that Mike Malin's team were able to get out of the Mars Global Surveyor, the mock camera. But there's so many that are really wonderful in here that anybody who just enjoys looking at Mars is also going to be pleased. I'm pretty amazed. There are three images here early in the book that are taken right out of a presentation that Wernher von Braun made in 1969 to the White House Space Task Group, and I wonder if these have really been seen very much in the last 40 years.
I had the same reaction when I first saw them, and I have to give a shout-out to Rob Godwin at Apogee Books, who put them in his little pocket guide to Mars that came out a few years ago, and he did a great job on that, and it was at the time that I was working on this book, he was very kind in sharing them with me. And they are remarkable because, you know, they're not what I would call great artwork. They're not anywhere near the level of wonderful renderings that Chesley Bonestell did or others in the years before the space age. I'm thankful that I have quite a few Bonestells in here, too, thanks to Ron Miller at Bonestell Space Art. But these images that you're talking about that were part of that 1969 presentation, they really show the future that might have been. And it's always fascinating to look at a future that didn't happen. But this was the plan that Wernher von Braun and his people came up with as something that Payne could pitch to the White House as part of the report from the Space Task Group in 1969. And their big ally in the White House was Spiro Agnew. In fact, he was so enthusiastic about space that he kind of drove some people in the White House crazy with it. May or may not have been the most effective person to have on your team, considering what happened to him later. But he nevertheless was a big proponent of sending humans to Mars. And so Payne asked von Braun to make this presentation, and so the illustrations show several moments from this proposed mission scenario, which would have taken place in the early to mid-1980s and would have featured several expeditions to Mars and showed how we would land there, how we would explore, how we would get back. But the most interesting thing about that whole period for me was when I discovered what von Braun himself had said shortly after that, after the White House had turned it down. He said, "You would probably think that I would be the most gung-ho man to Mars advocate right now." But he said, "Actually, I understand that, you have to have political will behind it." And that's something that I think is not really there. And that he said, NASA has become spoiled by Apollo. They're waiting for another president to come along on a white horse and hand them a planet the way Kennedy gave them the moon. And he said, "I think that they do that at their peril." And that was very interesting to me that, von Braun, who had always been the main Mars advocate of the entire country since coming to this country after World War II, he, of course, had been planning how to send humans to Mars since the 1940s. But von Braun saw the changing tide. And Payne was really the one who was the incurable visionary at a time when, boy, it really was not a very good time to be a visionary. And Payne understood that and told me that later when I interviewed him, 20 years after the fact.
Von Braun, in fact, you mentioned his prediction that it might be 100 years before we would reach Mars, which, very sadly, frustratingly for many of us, may turn out to be just about right. That is, humans to reach Mars.
That's right. He made that prediction in 1954 in Collier's Magazine, which was really the sort of seminal moment of consciousness raising for the American public in the impending reality of space exploration. Of course, it was several years before even the first satellites, but here was von Braun in a series of articles in Collier's, which had nationwide visibility, telling Americans that there were ways to send humans into space, to send them to the moon and even to Mars. And he sketched it out in great detail, illustrated, of course, by these spectacular paintings of Chesley Bonestell's. But that was in 1954, and he was looking at the same problems that we're wrestling with today, not only the technological issues, but the medical issues. How do you keep people healthy? How do you tend to their psychological well-being? They're going to be tremendously isolated from Earth. I think one of the things that many people don't think about when they think about sending humans to Mars, once you get out more than 1 million miles or so, the light travel times for your radio signals are so long that you can no longer have real-time conversations with anyone except your own crewmates. And the people who go to Mars will have a sense of isolation that no astronauts have ever had before, including the Apollo astronauts when they were orbiting the moon. So I think that the challenges, we've got problems in reliability of components. Things have to be incredibly reliable on a 3-year round trip to Mars. The dust of Mars itself may turn out to be toxic. It's very, very fine dust. It's going to be a tremendous nuisance and perhaps even a health hazard. I always think of a comment that Apollo 15 astronaut Dave Scott made to me when I was interviewing him for A Man on the Moon. And at one point, we got into a conversation, and this was in 1987, we got into a conversation about humans to Mars because, you know, I had been obviously spending time with the Case for Mars people, and I knew there was a lot of sentiment that was frustrated with NASA for not moving ahead on that. And Dave said to me, Mars is a tough job. Mm. He went on to explain more of why he felt that way, but that is, to me, saying it as well as anybody can say it. When I think about von Braun's statement in 1954 that it could be a century before we get to Mars with people, that would put it in the middle of this century. You know, I'd love to see it happen. I'd love to live long enough to see that happen. But on the other hand, what I really want is to see a space program that has exploration front and center, mm-hmm. and that is constructed in such a way that advances the cause of exploration, and not only with humans but with robots. They must work in synergy. The maximum benefit is going to come when you have both robotic missions and human follow-on missions. I think that asteroids are a tremendously promising target. I think that's something that we ought to look seriously at in the near term, not only because scientifically they're incredibly valuable, but because of the asteroid threat to our planet. We mm-hmm. must learn more about them in order to mitigate that threat. And also, it gives us experience that will be valuable going to Mars. You're starting to get into that realm where you're on your own. You're not going to be relying on mission control for solving your problems the way you can in Earth orbit. You're starting to cut the cord when you go to a near-Earth asteroid. So, you know, Mars is going to be out there as the driver, as the goal, for as far as we can see into the future. And when we get there, it's going to be spectacular. But I want us to go there in a way that is sustainable and that, as I say, has exploration front and center.
Hear, hear. And I find it very heartening to hear people like Steve Squires, principal investigator for the Mars Exploration Rovers. Here's a guy who has had as great a success with robotic exploration as anybody else, and yet he is still utterly committed to the importance of humans, human eyes and human hands going where these robots have gone.
Absolutely, and I take great comfort from the words of Ray Bradbury, who called us the betweens, and said that we human beings are on a journey ultimately to the stars, that Mars is a way station along that journey. And if it takes many generations to make that journey, then by God, we will still be pushing for it generations down the line. If you go back and turn the clock back to Percival Lowell or Robert Goddard, let's talk about Robert Goddard for a second. Robert Goddard, at the age of 18, sitting in the cherry tree on his property in Worcester, Massachusetts, having a vision of a device that would transport him to Mars. This is in the first years of the 20th century. Well, my God, you know, Goddard would have gone to Mars right then if there had been a space program. Mm-hmm. If that opportunity had been available, Robert Goddard would have gladly gone to Mars. But he did not live to see it. He didn't even live to see the robotic exploration of Mars. So it really is a quest that deserves a long-term commitment, and that's what it's going to take.
Andy, who do you look to now as those who are the torch has been handed to in the exploration of Mars?
I think many of the people who are doing Mars exploration now, the young scientists and engineers who are working on the current missions and future missions, the people who are just coming out of grad school and trying to tackle the mysteries that we're seeing with the data from HiRISE and the other new data that we're getting in, and of course analyzing the data that has been coming in the last several years. You know, it's the members of the Mars Society, young and old. It's the members of the Planetary Society, the people who tune into this broadcast and keep the flame alive. You know, I think that there is a perception out there that somehow the excitement of space exploration doesn't translate to the younger generations today. And I challenge that. I think that there is an explorer in every single one of us. It's innate in us. You know, it starts when we crawl from one room of our house to another when we're just learning to walk. It's in us, and it either gets nurtured or it gets beaten out of us. Hmm. But it's there. And I think that people don't realize, because it's been so long since anybody has been out of low Earth orbit, I don't think they realize how exciting it's going to be able to look up into the sky some night, at the moon even, and say, you know what, there are people living and working up there and discovering amazing things and making it possible for us to become a spacefaring species, a multi-planet species. And someday, people are going to be able to look up at Mars. We can't even see Mars with our eyes except as a bright star-like point of light in the sky. It looks like a star. It looks, you know, except for the fact that it moves differently and it doesn't twinkle and so forth. You know, we really, if we're able to look up at that bright orange dot and say there are humans living and working there, we truly will have passed a milestone for the human species that will be tremendously powerful. As I say, I hope I live to see that point. If I don't, I have every faith that it will happen.
Andy, we should let you go, but I got to compliment you on one more set of illustrations in the book. Nice work on the Mars occultation.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, right. Well, I was completely captivated by the 1911 occultation photo that was in National Geographic when I was, you know, 10 or 11 years old. And so when the 2003 closest approach came along and I found out there was going to be an occultation visible in Florida, I sprang into action and I turned myself into a Mars imager, at least for that event, and I'm very proud of what I was able to accomplish.
Well, as somebody who has also bounced along a road with my telescope rolling in the back seat of the car under a blanket, I can identify.
But did you do it in a hurricane?
No. I was not on the outskirts of a hurricane. Would you close this for us with really the way that you close the book, with a few words from the guy I think of as the original Martian, Ray Bradbury, right out of the last page of the book?
Let me start from the bottom of 271, okay?
Sure, go ahead.
In the summer of 2000, when I was working at space.com, I commissioned Ray Bradbury to write an essay about Mars for the debut issue of our print magazine, Space Illustrated. In his piece, Too Soon from the Cave, Too Far from the Stars, Bradbury called us celestial nomads halfway through a million-year journey, quote, looking back at the cliffs from which we sprang, looking up at a heaven that seems almost within reach. We are seemingly trapped in mid-stride, free of the protection of the solid rock in which we hid to invent fire. Now we stand unprotected in an invisible rain that showers from the universe and will either cleanse us or melt us to nothing. And so Bradbury, who as a 10-year-old boy beseeched an orange dot in the summer sky to take him home, put a pin in the map of what he has called our journey from romance to reality, saying, quote, we are the betweens. He also gave me the answer I didn't have for that college interviewer back in 1973 who asked, why Mars? Quote, we have been given eyes to see what the light year worlds cannot see of themselves, Bradbury wrote. We have been given hands to touch the miraculous. We have been given hearts to know the incredible. Can we shrink back to bed in our funeral clothes? Mars says we cannot.
Andy, thank you so much. It has been a tremendous thrill and great fun to have you on Planetary Radio.
Thank you,
Radio.
Matt. I really appreciate it. And, you know, on to Mars, as they say.
Ad Astra, as others say. I hope to have you back sometime. We'll eagerly await your next work.
Thank you, Matt.
Andrew Chaikin turned from planetary science to journalism almost 30 years ago. His A Man on the Moon, the triumphant story of the Apollo space program, was turned by Tom Hanks into From the Earth to the Moon, the award-winning HBO series. He's a former Sky and Telescope editor. He wrote for Space.com. He lectures often to young people, and you can hear him from time to time on National Public Radio and elsewhere. We will, as I said up front, put the link to his website, andrewchaikin.com, where you can always learn more about this show, planetary.org/radio. We'll be learning more about the current night sky from a guy who knows it pretty well, Bruce Betts, in this week's edition of What's Up. That'll be right after we hear from Emily.